The vice president is visiting the site of the Parkland shooting this weekend. Pembroke Pines just elected its youngest commissioner. Palm Beach County held municipal elections, and the Miami City manager's furniture controversy continues. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is out this week. In the next hour, we'll talk to the president of Stand with Parkland, Tony Montalto, about Vice President Kamala Harris's impending visit. We'll also speak to one of the youngest people voted onto the Pembroke Pines City Commission and hear the latest on Miami City Manager's business dealings with WLRN's investigations team. All that coming right up after the news. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is out this week. We begin this week in Parkland. Vice President Kamala Harris is scheduled to visit the halls of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School tomorrow. She will be accompanied by family members of victims killed in the 2018 mass shooting. The visit was organized by Democratic Congressman Jared Moskowitz, whose district includes the school. 14 students and 3 adults were killed, 17 were wounded. It was one of the deadliest school shootings on record in the United States, and it sparked a groundswell of student activism calling for tougher gun laws. The vice president oversees the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. White House officials say family members of the victims will show the vice president the path the shooter took and where the loved ones were killed. We are joined today by Tony Montalto. His daughter, Gina, was among the students killed that day at the high school. He is the founder and president of Stand with Parkland, a group advocating for public safety reforms for students and staff at schools nationwide. He will be joining the vice president on Saturday on her visit. Mr. Montalto, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Good afternoon, Sergio.
Mr. Montalto, the vice president's visit, what do you want her to know about what happened the day of the shooting, and what message do you plan to convey to her?
Well, Stand with Parkland, the National Association of Families for Safe Schools, founded by the families who had a loved one taken that terrible February day 6 years ago, has been involved on both the state and federal level to advocate for safer schools. Tomorrow, during the visit with the vice president, we're pleased, first of all, to still see school safety getting such a high amount of attention from the highest office in the land. We're also going to talk about what failed that day, what failed prior to that day, what's been done, especially in Florida, to mitigate these tragedies and help prevent them, as well as point out things that need to be done further. One of the things that we hope she'll take away from that is the need to help us pass the Eagles Act, named for the mascot at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, which would provide additional funding to the U.S. Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center to go out into local communities to train school officials, mental health professionals, and law enforcement professionals on the vital process of behavioral threat assessment. We passed a law requiring that here in Florida. It's been very successful, and we're pleased of the support we've gotten from FDLE, the Office of Safe Schools, as well as the governor's office.
Interesting. Mr. Montalto, last July, you and other Parkland families visited the building where the shooting happened. At the time, you told reporters that you had mixed emotions in the visit: sadness, anger, disbelief. Could you tell us what you learned from that visit last summer?
Well, that summer I learned that there's a snowball of emotions each time we enter the building. Since then, we've taken numerous Florida elected officials. We've taken federal officials, such as the Secretary of Education a few months ago. We've also taken the Secret Service Director, the head of the cybersecurity and infrastructure agency. Anybody who is responsible to touch on the safety of our children and our teachers at school, we've tried to work with. We've tried to show them the things I mentioned before, the failures that occurred leading up to it, the failures that occurred that day, and how we can help mitigate this and prevent it. Of course, we all tell the story of our family member. My wife and I talk about our beautiful daughter, Gina, who was taken from us in such a horrific way when the shooter pressed the muzzle of his weapon against her chest and pulled the trigger, much as he had researched that fact online. That's why it's so important to be as proactive as we possibly can to look for the people that are exhibiting these troubling behaviors and then get them the help they need before they resort to violence.
Well, we certainly send our condolences again to you and your family. I know it's even after 6 years, I know the pain would never go away. Let me ask you, though, a couple months ago, it was said that the building that the VP's touring tomorrow was going to be demolished. Yet we've seen it, I guess, in these tours or visits. But do you know if the building is still on track to be demolished? And what do you and other members of your organization think about this?
Well, we understand the desire for the community to have it taken down. We need to have it replaced with an appropriate memorial to the victims that were taken that day. Right now, though, while it is standing, and we believe it will be standing at least to the end of school this year, it's an opportunity. Again, it's an opportunity to point out in person to people involved with school safety, to people involved and have the ability to change laws and policies. Again, to show what caused this, what can be done, the importance of changing a multitude of laws and policies. Stand With Parkland uses our school safety triad, which is securing each campus, improving mental health screening and support programs, and finally, if you choose to own one, exercising responsible firearms ownership. All three of those things we saw get passed in Florida back in 2018 on the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act. We have seen positive things like red flag laws used over 12,000 times here in this state and in some of the most Republican counties, some of the most Democratic counties. The sheriffs like them because they help protect law enforcement and the citizenry. In Florida, we got it right. We have appropriate due process to those laws, and we're happy to see them still standing. Additionally, the Florida legislature has come together every year to pass at least one school safety bill. Many of those have been bipartisan, and quite frankly, most of them have been unanimously approved and signed into law by both Governor Scott and Governor DeSantis.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is off this week. I'm speaking with Tony Montalto, president of Stand With Parkland and father of Gina Montalto, ahead of Vice President Kamala Harris's walkthrough of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Mr. Montalto, I want to get into what you just mentioned. You founded Stand With Parkland and continue to work with other family members of the victims from that day. You have pushed for laws to improve school security, including red flag laws that you mentioned. Are there any other priorities in terms of public policies that your group is pursuing?
Sure. So we've been very successful in getting some laws here passed in Florida, one of which is a requirement that schools notify parents of a threat to the school, to school-sponsored transportation, or to a school-sponsored event. That's been in law here for a couple of years, and we've seen it be quite effective. But there's not one nationally. So we are working with Congressman Moskowitz to have that requirement put into law nationally. Additionally, after walking through the building numerous times, we've seen that we need to enhance the doors in instructional spaces. The shooter in Parkland never walked into a classroom. He shot everybody and wounded everybody from the hallway. He was able to shoot through the glass panel on the door. His bullets penetrated the apparently solid-looking steel doors. But there are ballistic materials we can use. We are looking to make that a requirement here in the state of Florida, beginning with new buildings and then working on a retrofit program. we think that this would be invaluable. We spend a lot of money putting fire equipment in our schools, and nobody blinks an eye at it because we know that it saved lives. But we need to build our schools to protect children from the dangers they face in the 21st century as well. And that's why this requirement for ballistic doors is something we're working on through a grant process, and again, through state and hopefully federal law.
It seems by bringing public officials to the building, it's a very effective lobbying tool, if you will. But how have officials that have toured the site responded, at least to you personally?
Personally, they have empathy for our families. Mm-hmm. They all say they can't imagine the loss of your child at a school where they should be safe. They can't imagine a spouse who goes to work and then doesn't come home after an event like this. And they know that they can do better. They know that they can do more. You mentioned earlier that Vice President Harris is head of the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Having a single office begin to coordinate the federal effort is something that, quite frankly, had bipartisan support. We hear that frequently from the Republicans when we go up to Capitol Hill, that we don't need new laws, we just need to enforce the laws that are on the books. Well, here's an office that is doing just that. They've been helping to implement the money and the programs that were set forth in the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. We've seen that the Luke and Alex School Safety Act, which was also passed as part of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, has codified the existence of schoolsafety.gov and the federal clearinghouse of best practices. We've seen that bring together the departments of education, of health and human services, of Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security, all working together to curate the information on that site. It's a one-stop shop for anybody who's interested in the safety of our children and our teachers at school. And again, that Luke and Alex School Safety Act was named after Luke Hoyer and Alex Schachter, two of the victims here in Parkland.
Turning your attention to the local government response, are you satisfied with our local government and restrictions that are placed on safety in our schools here in Broward and in South Florida? I'm talking about, you know, searches for book bags and pocketbooks for visitors, those kinds of things. Are you satisfied with that response and the restrictions put into place?
Well, we've seen continued improvement. I believe that just this week we saw a report saying that Broward Schools is going to start with walk-through metal detectors at some point in the future.
Do you think that's part of the solution to making schools safer, that move made by Broward, the school board?
I do, and I think that Broward was one of the last places to do some of the very simple things, such as mark off the safe corners and things like that in a room. But we've seen a dramatic change since we got rid of Superintendent Runcie and some of the other roadblocks that were on the school board. And we have to understand that school safety is an ever-changing target, right? There's no room for complacency. There's no room for stopping, right? We just have to continue to invest in the safety of America's future, which is our children and our teachers at school.
Well said. We were talking about the previous superintendent, Robert Runcie, is who you mentioned. Is there anything else you want parents, teachers, and our listeners to know about public safety in schools?
Well, I think the best thing that you can do is sign up at standwithparkland.org, join our email list, keep yourself apprised of the important initiatives that are coming down. Pay attention to our tool that we have to contact your representatives. We've tried to make it easy for you. You just put your name in and your address, and it pre-populates. And then there are a few letters that, if you like, you just click send, and away they go. We change that as we need to support important legislative initiatives as they come down the pike. But most importantly, at standwithparkland.org, you can also go to our resources page and find the results of studies from the U.S. Secret Service, the result of studies from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission, where you can look for suicide prevention tools, where you can find additional information on the safe storage of firearms. There's a multitude of issues. There's no one answer. So please come together with us at standwithparkland.org and be part of the team.
Again, standwithparkland.org. I just want to talk to the last thing I want to ask you is tomorrow, who is going to be joining you, the vice president, on the tour of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas?
Oh, I don't have a list of all the other families, so I don't want to leave anybody out, but I'll try and tell you who I know. I know that the Hickson family, mm-hmm. the Guttenbergs, Schachters, I believe the Shentrups, whilst their beautiful daughter Carmen are coming into town. And I'm sure there's going to be others, and I apologize if I left it off, but I have not seen a complete list.
Fantastic.
But the key is, you know, that we have a lot of people who are actively involved in school safety. A lot of the families have been very motivated. Most of us work with Stand With Parkland. Some of us are working on other projects, but, you know, it's bringing people together to solve this problem. And that's what we try and do at Stand With Parkland.
Thank you again. That's standwithparkland.org. Tony Montalto is the founder and president of Stand With Parkland. Mr. Montalto, thank you again for joining us today.
Thanks, Sergio.
Still to come, we talk to one of the youngest people elected to the Pembroke Pines City Commission and what happened Tuesday in the Palm Beach elections with WLRN's Palm Beach reporter, Wilkin Brutus. Call us 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is out this week. Tuesday this week was an election day. Yes, it was the Republican preference primary, but local municipalities in South Florida also held their own elections. Candidates faced off to win city commission seats, mayoral seats, and others. In Broward County's Pembroke Pines, Maria Rodriguez defeated three other candidates to win a seat on the city commissioner, making her the youngest commissioner in the city's history. At age 28, she is no stranger to public service, however. Originally from Columbia, she is a product of Silver Trail Middle School and West Broward High School. She currently works with County Commissioner Tim Ryan as his communications and outreach coordinator. Maria Rodriguez joins us now to talk about the local political landscape. Welcome, Ms. Rodriguez. And for our listeners, do you have any questions for the newly elected Pembroke Pines City Commissioner? Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Welcome again. Congratulations. You are the first Colombian American local elected official in Broward and the next commissioner on the Pembroke Pines Commission, District 3. I want to begin with a little bit more global perspective, Ms. Rodriguez. At a time when many people are turned off by politics, especially young people, why did you decide to run for public office?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me here today. I'm excited to talk all about this topic, especially. I think it's really important for everybody to realize that although we pay so much attention on what's going on globally and in Washington, D.C., some of the policies that affect us the most are actually what goes on in our own city halls. So when our trash is picked up, whether our pothole is fixed, how the traffic is in our own cities actually depends a lot on our local community and our local government. So that is one of the reasons that I ended up getting in this race, because I really wanted a say in how the city developed, not just for my future, but for everybody's future here in Pembroke Pines. And I think it's really important for especially young people to get involved in local politics, to get to know their city commissioners, to get to know their county commissioners, state representatives, the whole deal, because those are the people that have a unique impact on your everyday life. And it's crucial for us to know, to voice our opinions, to voice our concerns, and for these representatives to be held accountable to the communities that they serve. So I think it's, you know, crucial if you want to run for office, run for office. If you want to simply get to know your commissioner, feel free to reach out. They are neighbors that create policy and they should be representing you and your voice.
You know, it's interesting, as you mentioned, So few people even vote in an election that I would say, and I think others say, is arguably more impact on one's daily life, as you talked about. Yet voter turnout for the municipal elections in Broward was only about 14%. Not unusual, but always very low in these municipal elections. In your race, it was less than 4,600 people actually voted. Getting back a little bit to my earlier questions, why do you think people are turned off by politics or are not showing up in these great numbers to vote?
I think one of the questions for the city of Pembroke Pines specifically, or these March elections, are that they happen in March. People are just not aware. If they are aware of elections, they typically think it's more in November. So it's bringing that awareness, either moving our elections to November, but that does have its pros and cons, but making sure people are aware we're engaging with our constituents and our residents annually, and making sure that it's not just right before elections that they know this is going on, having a full campaign educational program and letting them know that their local government matters and that elections are, whatever they are, but not just bringing it up in the new year for a March election, but making sure we're consistently talking about elections and the importance of them and really educating residents about how they can voice their concerns, not just at the ballot box, but if they have a question about city services, who they can reach out to, or if they have some concerns about a certain policy, how they can speak at city commission. So it's about getting to know people and reaching them where they are, and most importantly, educating them that they have a voice and that they can use that voice to advocate for themselves and their families.
You mentioned educating and engaging. Along the campaign trail, I'm curious, what was on voters' minds in Pembroke Pines? What did they talk about with you? What changes do they want to see in their city? And did they even mention things on national issues?
When I got to doors and I knocked about 15,000 doors, so I did get to talk to a large part of our community. One of the things that was talked about a lot was traffic, as I'm sure a lot of people do in Broward or in the South Florida area. Traffic was a big issue. We don't have very good light synchronization, so you're stopping at almost every single light and on some of our main boulevards. In Pembroke Pines, we also don't have a recycling program, so people were really concerned. I'll usually point out, oh, I see that your blue bin is still here, the recycling bin. I want to make sure we're putting those blue bins to work. And then lastly, that lack of accessibility to government, especially for non-English speakers. It's so important for us to make government as accessible as possible. And people really lit up when I was able to talk to them in either in Spanish or in French to make sure that I was really listening to them and hearing out what concerns they were having.
That's interesting. Now, what do you hope to accomplish as a newly elected commissioner in Pembroke Pines? People may not realize this, but and truth be told, in full disclosure, I'm a Pembroke Pines resident, and I was met at the door by one of your campaign workers. It's one of South Florida's biggest cities. It's home to more than 171,000 residents. So what do you hope to accomplish as a newly elected commissioner, given these priorities you outlined?
So one of the things that I really like to focus on is hearing out residents and having some constant communication with them. I want to make sure we're doing some monthly newsletters, talking to people. I ideally don't want to lose the practice of door knocking and making sure that we're door knocking and consistently talking to residents, because we can think of the policies ourselves. We can see kind of with our own eyes what is wrong, whether it's the traffic or lack of recycling. But there's a lot of other things that people point out. And I think, I can be as observant as I can, but it's crucial for us to have our eyes and ears as the constituents themselves. And then they can make sure to let me know what are the issues that they're seeing in their city. And then we can create some policy or have a reaction to that effectively and efficiently.
Fantastic. Maria Rodriguez is the newly elected District 3 Commissioner in Pembroke Pines. Maria, thank you so much for joining us on the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I'm glad I got to talk to a neighbor in the
Fantastic. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos, in for Tim Padgett this week. As we continue looking at local elections across South Florida, we now welcome Wilkin Brutus, WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Wilkin, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Sergio, thanks for having me.
Before we get into our discussion, I want to ask our listeners, did you vote in Palm Beach County this week? If so, call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Now, Wilkin, this week's elections took place in more than half of Palm Beach County's 39 municipalities. The election results show that Palm Beach County will see a slew of new faces elected to local offices. Before we talk about specific races, I was personally impressed with voter turnout. It was 22% countywide. I thought that seemed like a strong showing of voters for, again, municipal elections, which historically draw low voter interest. Why do you think people were so motivated to come out to the polls in this particular municipal election?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you certainly felt it in the air. I mean, there were a lot at stake. President Joe Biden and Donald Trump clinched support from their respective parties in the presidential preference primary election. We had several mayoral races and a number of significant ballot items to vote on. All of these sort of variables helped increase the number of people to the polls. Like you said, 23 of the 39 municipalities in Palm Beach County held elections, and about 22% of the more than 500,000 eligible voters cast ballots, majority of whom voted by mail, Sergio. So that also made in-person voting a breeze for a lot of voters.
What were some of your key takeaways from Tuesday night's municipal elections in Palm Beach County?
Yeah, I think one key takeaway is that voters selected mayors from eight municipalities, from Royal Palm Beach in the western part of the county to Lake Worth Beach in the central part and Delray Beach in the southern part. And so also ballot items really stood out in many places. For example, voters who live in five geographical areas in the city of Palm Beach Gardens, which is in the northern part of the county, wanted to annex these particular geographic areas. Well, the voters there decided against joining the city. All five of that annexation ordinances on the ballot were overwhelmingly voted down, each by more than 90%. And so you saw people really expressing their right to vote and making their voices heard.
Interesting. Now, I understand you visited the polls before the election. What did you hear from voters? What are the issues they were mostly concerned about?
Right. Like I said, there were a lot more vote by mail, so I didn't see a lot of people at the polls, which I assume there's going to be far more people come August during the primaries. But I did happen to speak with a man named Joseph Chamberlain, who's a 77-year-old retired civil engineer. He has quite the backstory. He'd served two tours in Vietnam as a combat gunner's mate in the Navy. He and his wife were snowbirds who didn't really get into local politics until recently. And he referred to himself as an independent. And he told me that immigration and a lack of housing availability, especially for lower-income people and veterans, were among some of the issues that drew him and his wife to the polls.
Excellent. Just want to clarify one point you made just to make sure we know that there was actually no primary for the Democratic presidential preference. Democrats in Florida went ahead and gave the electoral votes to President Joe Biden. There was the Republican presidential primary,
Exactly.
even though, again, as you noted, both candidates have been are presumed the nominees. Let me turn your attention again to the mayoral elections, Wilkin. One ended in a runoff. What have you heard from voters in Lake Worth Beach about these results? And when is the runoff election for Lake Worth Beach?
Yeah, let's talk about that really quick. So Lake Worth Beach Mayor Betty Resch won the most votes, but winning by less than 50% of the election vote automatically triggered a runoff. So Mayor Resch and former Vice Mayor and Commissioner Andy Amoroso are heading to a runoff, which is scheduled for April 2nd. And so voters are definitely interested in resolving ongoing issue surrounding a planned Gulfstream hotel, which has been in discussion for quite some time and has sparked all sorts of controversies. And also, a lot of voters feel that if the hotel is completed, it could bring much needed economic activity in the city. Another main concern for voters in Lake Worth Beach in particular is the homelessness crisis and housing issues. Housing is the overwhelming through line when it comes to these elections. Now, in Delray Beach, which is about 20 minutes south of Lake Worth Beach, former mayor and commissioner Tom Carney won that mayoral race by large margins. And, you know, he's definitely a familiar face who had served a number of boards and other high profile positions. And voters in Delray, Sergio, were most likely enticed by his main priorities, which include reducing overdevelopment in Delray Beach and traffic congestion. And also one of his main campaign priorities was basically to find ways to reduce property taxes. And so, yeah, just a gamut of issues.
And has the date been set for the runoff election for Lake Worth Beach for the mayor?
Yes. The runoff election between Lake Worth Mayor Betty Resch and former city commissioner Andy Amoroso is scheduled for April 2nd.
All right. Well, and there were also some referendums on the ballot this week. Riviera Beach voters, for instance, overwhelmingly approved a $100 million bond to fund infrastructure projects. Could you tell us more about this?
Yeah, $100 million. It actually totaled to $115 million. Officials plan to use that borrowed money to finance and renovate crumbling municipalities across Riviera Beach, and some $55 million to replace and renovate several major parks and recreational facilities. A city spokesperson said $35 million would replace a police station, which the city hopes will improve call response times, as well as $25 million to replace a 1970s era fire station. And so the referendum is essentially part of this long-term, quote, reimagine Riviera Beach campaign to attract more investors, but also to improve the city.
Interesting. Usually voters want to see less spending, not more. But I guess these were projects they definitely wanted. In West Palm Beach, turning your attention there, voters approved increasing the residency period required for elected officials who run for office from 6 months to 12 months. They also voted in favor of restricting the position of mayor from having outside professional work. What exactly motivated these ballot referendums?
So, Sergio, this is a bit more complex than the other races here and or other ballot items. Mm-hmm. This has been an intense back and forth. So let's take it back. The West Palm Beach City Commission last October unanimously approved to have that package of items that you just mentioned on the ballot. This after a judge had ruled that local restaurateur and popular businessman Rodney Mayo, who was the only candidate to challenge West Palm Beach Mayor Keith James, he was ruled ineligible to run because Mayo did not meet the residential requirement to run, which is to live in the city for at least 6 months. And so Rodney Mayo's disqualification means another 4-year term for the current mayor, Keith James. As to what motivated the ballot items, James told the Palm Beach Post that longer residency requirement puts the city in line with other similar municipalities across the state, and that the restrictions on work ensures the duties of the mayor's office. And so that's his sort of response to the ballot items.
Excellent. Well, again, good to see the strong voter turnout in Palm Beach County. Wilkin Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Thanks again, Wilkin, for joining us today.
Sergio, thanks for having me.
Still to come, Miami City Manager files a report on his furniture contract controversy, but questions remain. WRN's investigative team joins us to talk about it. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is out this week. WLRN listeners may recall that a couple months ago, WLRN reported that the Miami City Manager, Art Noriega, wanted to refurnish his office and the offices of other city staff members. The city ended up awarding more than $440,000 in contracts to a company called Paredes Manufacturing, which is owned by the family of Noriega's wife, Michelle Paredes Noriega. When the news broke in January, the city manager promised a, quote, full reporting and accounting, unquote, of the business dealings. This week, Noriega issued his report to the city's furniture purchasers, but WLRN's investigations team found that the report omitted tens of thousands of dollars paid to his in-laws and furniture company. Joining me now in the program are WLRN investigative reporters Joshua Ceballos and Danny Rivero. What do you think about the city manager's furniture contracts? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Again, welcome to the show, Danny.
Thanks for having me. Hey, thanks for having us, Sergio.
Sure. Tell us what you first reported in January after getting a tip to look into the contracts between the city of Miami and the furniture company owned by Mr. Noriega's wife. Government ethics experts have said the contracts appeared to be a clear conflict of interest.
Right. You know, as you mentioned, after getting a tip, essentially we got city invoices, city contracts, some spreadsheets from the city listing the expenditures with this particular furniture company ever since Art Noriega became city manager in 2020, just right before the pandemic. So anything within that window, we requested all the expenditures, contracts with the city and whatnot. And among them, we found, or the records showed, I should say, that the city manager, his office was refurbished essentially by his wife. His wife was listed as the salesperson on the invoices. Public funds were spent on it. We got all the records. There was many other things happening in different departments. Part of it was the city manager's own office contracted essentially to his wife. So we started asking questions and saying, you know, is this ethical? Because there's a lot of times this kind of thing is not supposed to happen. And you know, the question of, is it legal? Is it not legal? That's for a lawyer to determine. But what we were told by some ethics experts we consulted with is, you know, a big part of ethics is, does this look like it could be bad? And we were told this looks like it could be bad.
Right. And we should add that the company Pradere Manufacturing, which is owned by his wife's family, she's the director of operations, but her parents own it. They've been doing business with the city for over a decade. They're a furniture vendor with the city. But what we really wanted to focus on was the period when Art Noriega himself was city manager, because he's the city's top administrator. He is the boss of operations for the whole city. And that's when, like, the what we felt was a big possibility for conflict of interest.
So in January, just to recap, you come out with this story noting the furniture contracts and the apparent conflict of interest. But tell us, Josh, why this Miami city manager decided to issue his own report on the city's contracts with his wife's furniture company.
Right. Well, so I think that came out of a lot of pressure from the public after our initial reporting. And obviously, other reporters and other outlets kind of joined the call once we did our initial report, looking into these transactions. And I think people were asking very loudly, can we get an explanation for this? How is it that his wife's family company is doing business with the city if he is the top administrator? So pretty quickly after our initial story came out, he went in front of the commission and said, I'm going to give a full report because I want to clear the air. He said, you know, the reports in the media were inaccurate or incomplete, and he wanted to give his full explanation. And he had promised to do that at the January 24th meeting, but then it took 2 months for that report to finally come out.
So you all both come out with your story. Noriega then comes out with his report, and you both reviewed it.
Right.
What did you end up finding that there was what had he been omitting?
Right. So yeah. So I mean, what happens a lot when you're doing this kind of work, investigative work, is when a government entity especially puts out a report or puts something like this, you want to fact check them. You want to make sure that everything is up to snuff. And what really stood out to me when I got the report that came with a PowerPoint presentation was that Noriega said from the period 2023 to 2023 while he was city manager, the city had only spent like a little less than $300,000 with Pradere Manufacturing. And that didn't jive with what we reported, which was that they were awarded $440,000.
Right.
So, we started looking through. Like, Noriega also sent this Excel sheet with all of these purchases. And we went through each and every single purchase order and transaction. And we found that there were 22 missing transactions that we had in our initial public records that he did not put out in his report.
Right. And just to, explain the process, I guess. When the first report came out, we got documents and records from the city, with including all sorts of information. And then for the city manager's report, he put it out, and we just cross-checked it. Do these things match? And there was a lot of missing information. It was not a full and complete report that he promised. So we did our jobs, and we said, well, this is not complete.
What's interesting about this is you both are, in a sense, looking at the same records. It's not as if you got different public records. He's got his own records. But how did Noriega and his staff end up explaining the omissions in the report that amounted to tens of thousands of dollars?
Right. Well, essentially, they walked back that report that had been over 2 months in the coming, and they retracted it. They said, they said there was, quote, anomalies in the search, and they basically, are putting it on a department that did the searches for it. Apparently, they only searched for the word furniture, and they didn't search for other things. So, like, shelving units and remodeling services, things like that were not accounted for in it. So they say they're going to come back and do another report. I honestly don't know if that's going to include things that we don't already know. I mean, we were not told anything in the report that was issued that we didn't have. There was just omitted information.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically what we saw was the procurement office, which prepared this report. They have this system, this database called Oracle, where they can go through all of the purchases that they've done, and they put in the search term furniture. And that spat out, all this data, all the furniture purchases during these years, but that not all of the purchases from Pradere Manufacturing had the code for furniture. Some of it was office supplies. Some of it was stuff that, like Danny was saying, like shelves and stuff that seemed like furniture, but for one reason or another was not coded in the database as furniture. So that didn't come up, and so that wasn't in the report. Right?
Yeah, it seems like it's a question of what's the definition of furniture. Anyway, this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos, in for Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Danny Rivero and Joshua Ceballos about the recent coverage of the Miami City Manager's furniture controversy. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. As you mentioned, the city says it'll release a new report. Is this finally going to put some end to the controversy? Or?
I don't know.
We don't know until we see it, right?
Yeah, I mean, but it is worth mentioning that this big mistake, and the city manager's office admits this was a mistake, this report. They retracted the report. They say they're going to issue another one. I mean, that comes on the backdrop of a city commissioner calling for his resignation. Mm-hmm. Because of the ethical questions coming up, a former city manager calling for his resignation. It's been months coming. He said there's going to be a full report. The report comes out. It's not full. It's not answering really any questions about the ethical. He says this was ethical, but we don't have any new information.
And I was just going to say, yes, just to clarify, it was Miami Commissioner Miguel Gabella called for his resignation. And people who are plugged into Miami politics would know that Miguel Gabella also called for the resignation of the city attorney, Victoria Mendez, who is going to be out in a couple of months. And other commissioners have also called this into question. Commissioner Manolo Reyes on the dais was like, people are curious about this. Can you give us a full report? And he sent this incomplete report to the commissioners and to the mayor, and it doesn't have all the information. So it's going to be very interesting to see next Thursday at the commission meeting what they say to him about this.
Yeah, I was going to say that even after the first story, there was a public outcry and calls for Mr. Noriega's resignation, including from former city managers. What has the city manager commented at this point, other than saying he's given his report?
He hasn't, after this new report's come out, he hasn't really said anything. When we reached out to the city to ask for a one-on-one interview with him, they said his schedule was full this week and that he might be able to meet with us next week. And I know the Miami Herald reported that they were supposed to speak with him this week, and then he canceled the interview. So he hasn't really said much publicly. His go-to line has been that there was a firewall between him and his wife's business, that he has no involvement in the purchases. But now I think there's new questions about this report.
And you know, I'll mention it because I don't know if we've mentioned it in this conversation, but in 2020, when he came in, he did file a memo, an internal memo in the city, saying that he has a conflict of interest with this vendor that's connected to his wife and his wife's family. He did issue that. We do know that. But he also told us that he made a decision not to seek an ethics opinion from the County Commission on Ethics, which is very standard policy. I mean, elected officials know to do that. They do it frequently. And he told us he made a decision not to do that. And he wrote in his statement he put out with his report this week that, you know, he's been in contact with the Ethics Commission. The Ethics Commission essentially says they don't quite know what he's referring to because they haven't talked to him.
Well, after our reporting, he did reach out to the Ethics Commission, and I got some public records from the Ethics Commission where they emailed him and said, you know, if you'd like to do like open a formal investigation, like we can do that, but we can't give you an opinion for something that you've already done. You know, this is why people ask for opinions before going, and so now they can't really look backwards. So that's the communication that he's had.
Just so we can understand, our listeners can understand, what is the conflict of interest at stake here? I mean, let's just put it in plain language. What's at stake in terms of what is the conflict of interest that he has?
Right. I mean, so to put it in very concrete terms, there's contracts where his wife was a salesperson remodeling and furnishing his office. He's the city manager. He controls the day-to-day operations of the city. They live in the same household. They are domestic partners. They're spouses. Any money that she's making on commissions or anything through purchases that essentially he's controlling as a top city administrator go into one of their bank accounts at the end of the day. That is what it is. Money that is being spent by the city is coming back into the household in some shape or form.
And that's the big thing about conflict of interest laws is you don't want government officials or employees to enrich themselves on the public's dollar, on the taxpayer dollars, because the city money is the people's money. And if that money isn't going into the pockets of city employees twice, they're double dipping. And that's unfair. And we should say with his new report, Art Noriega also issued a new administrative policy in the city that started on March 11th. And basically that new policy says anybody who has a potential conflict of interest with a company that is doing business with the city or wants to do business with the city, so any employee that has that has to come before the city commission at a public meeting and also the public and declare it in a discussion item. Say, hey guys, X company wants to do business with the city. That's my Theo. That's my dad. And I just need you to know that the commissioners will discuss it. And they also have to get an opinion from the Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics.
And we have been told that is a good policy.
Yes.
And that should have probably been in place earlier, but it's very good that the city has implemented it now.
Yeah.
And if you had to finish up here, what's the next step in this whole thing?
The new report? We're waiting on it.
And also just, you know, after more than 2 months of saying the report's coming, it's going to answer all the questions. The report came out. It was retracted. There's more questions being asked now. Just what's, you know, in the next public meeting, public setting, like how are the other elected officials going to interact with this? Because he sent this to them and it was supposed to answer all these questions and it did not.
And Miguel Gabella did publicly call for his resignation. So at the next commission meeting, we're going to see if he pushes that forward and if anybody else is going to be, you know, backing him up on that.
Great. Well, again, excellent reporting. Danny Rivera and Joshua Ceballos are investigative reporters at WLRN. Danny, Josh, thanks again for joining us here on the South Florida Roundup.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Finally, on the roundup, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. That familiar tune means baseball season is back. Our home team, the Miami Marlins, opening day is on Thursday, March 28th. After a very memorable 2023 season, where the Marlins made it to the Major League Baseball playoffs for the fourth time in the franchise's history, the team is heading back to Lone Depot Park, hopefully to pick up where they left off. The Miami Marlins will face off against the Pittsburgh Pirates on Thursday. The first pitch is at 4:10 p.m. For its 1, 2, 3 segments, and we're out here at South Florida Roundup. That will do it for us. Our show is produced by Helen Acevedo with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mayers. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Sergio Bustos, the BP for news for here at WLRN. Have a great weekend, and thanks again for listening.
WLRN Public Media.